You too, my friend, are a good writer. It's great to see you.
Thank you.
Best to the family. Your latest book is The Doomsday Clock at 75. It is, Rob Elder, done in collaboration with the inimitable J.C. Gable, among the most beautiful books I have ever seen in my life. How was this book born? What's the seed of this book?
It is. So the Doomsday Clock, so for people who might not know, is a symbol, and it was created by
born in Chicago.
Yeah, born in Chicago. Martil Langsdorff, created by a landscape painter. Her husband was part of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, where I worked until recently.
Explain what that is. It's a magazine.
Well, it's more than that. You know, it's a nonprofit. They do have a publishing arm, a website, and as well as a paid magazine. Rachel Bronson is their CEO and president, and my good friend. And they have transformed into this amazing voice and community for people interested in nuclear risk, climate change, and disruptive technology.
Basically, they're interested in the future of this planet.
Right. And making sure there is one.
That's the other thing. The whole notion of the Doomsday Clock has ever... My father was a big UFC guy, so I knew about this, you know, virtually from the time I was born. He was a few years older than I am, not 75. but it is worked its way into, and one of the great things about this book is not just here's a story of the Doomsday Clock and where it was born, blah, blah, the way in which it's worked its way into culture.
Yeah. So the Doomsday Clock itself, it's a symbol for how close we are to self-destruction. That's what it is. It's a metaphor. And part of the part of its function is to get us talking about these things. The time matters because there's a whole bunch of scientists and experts who weigh in. But it gets us talking about it. It raises awareness. And so
initially it was started because of the shadow of nuclear holocaust.
Correct.
And then later expanded into climate change.
Yeah, the last 15 years. Yeah. And then more recently, again, disruptive technology. And that's not just drones and things like cloning and whatnot, but also mis and disinformation. So they pay very, very close attention to that. And as you said, it has been a force in pop culture. You know, we talk about the like dozen songs that it ends up in, everything from, you know, The Who to
Sting, the
Clash, Smashing Pumpkins, Midnight Oil. We go through all that.
And the way it's worked its way into movies from, you know, Dr. Strangelove, the Simpsons movie, Justice League, TV shows. How was this? Who's did you call J.C. Gable and say, hey, J.C., you live in California now, and you know, we've been friends, and I really admire you, and you have a book company called Hat and Beard.
Yeah, and he had published two of my other books, so I've known him for a long time, Moby Dick, illustrated by Gilbert Wilson, now on sale.
We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk a lot about your books.
But he had known Martil Langsdorff, the creator. You know, he had visited her house.
He has a piece in the book about that.
You know, he's the co-editor with me. And her house, which is the Schweiker House, which is still out there in Schaumburg, which you can tour now, which is amazing. So he knew her, and you know, she has a complicated legacy because she knew that this Doomsday Clock was going to be in the first line of her obituary, but she was a lifelong landscape painter.
And she'd also done
like really modern pieces, you know, these sort of 3D you know, pieces later in her career. So she was an artist who always kept growing, but she knew that her legacy was tied to this very powerful symbol, which is so much more, like, it transcends language. It's easy to understand.
You know, you and JC write, the Doomsday Clock is many things all at once. It's a metaphor, it's a logo, it's a brand, and it's one of the most recognizable symbols of the past 100 years. We'll take a commercial break. We'll then come back and talk to Rob Elder about his own career. Rob, Rob and I met when he started the Sun Times, and we shared at that time a mutual affection and for Ken Kesey. Mm. And, of course, Rob wrote a book about Ken Kesey. He knew Ken Kesey. I'm just simply an admirer from afar. And then we will get deep into the doomsday clock at 75. It just is, simply put, a magnificent book. The writing is terrific, but graphically it's unbelievably beautiful. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. I'm here with Robert K. Elder. We met at the Tribune, not at the Sun-Times. We have been, before the show, talking about the Sun-Times and what's going on with that paper. He's here specifically to talk about the Doomsday Clock at 75, his latest book, written, co-edited with the inimitable J.C. Gable, about whom we'll talk. Now we're going to talk about Rob. I mentioned that he had done a book about Ken Kesey. It's not really a book. You contributed to it.
Yeah, Conversations with Ken Kesey. I met him when I was like 16 years old in Billings, Montana. And
how did you meet him?
I was doing a piece for my school paper, and I actually ended up doing it for Merlin's Pen, which was a national magazine for students, and it was an interview with him, and it was great. I didn't know much about him, but he was this wonderful, like, caring guy, and he sort of, like, walked me through and was very patient.
Yeah, great hero of mine.
Yeah. Like, we remained friends until his death, and I actually went to the University of Oregon. He sort of said, hey, come on out to the University of Oregon. I teach a class out there. Of course, then I go, and he never teaches again.
He's just, no, I can't teach this kid anything. You have become one of the most prolific authors that I know. I'm not going to say you had a thing for, but Hemingway is another one of the people who was intrigued you, not only as a human being, mm-hmm. but as a writer.
Yeah. And we were talking before, but in the next couple years, I will have totaled 4 books that are Hemingway related.
First two are so vastly different. One is Hidden Hemingway, and the other is called Hemingway in Comics.
In Comics, yeah. And so Hemingway in Comics, which I always say is the silliest book to ever get a book deal, has turned into this thing.
It's one of the great, it's also, Rob Elder, one of the great book covers of all time.
Yeah.
Describe the book
it's
cover.
It's Steve Ralston. It's Hemingway sort of like almost like punching the title. It's really, really great. And it's really about what happens when you become larger than your legacy. What happens when you become a pop culture figure and how people do that. So the book tracks the 120 plus appearances across the world where Hemingway shows up with, like, Mickey Mouse in Italy, with Superman, with Wolverine in a time travel adventure. And it has gotten so out of hand that this month, I'm going to the San Diego Comic-Con, where we're going to have a panel about it, but we will also debut a art exhibit that it'll start in July. We'll have a little preview in August. It's the full exhibit. And then that exhibit will go on tour with Exhibits USA throughout the nation for the next 5 years.
5 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Would they be selling your book?
They'll be selling the book and whatnot, but it's a larger thing than Beyond the Book.
Yeah.
But again, it's this thing that won't die. You know, I got a sort of another book project out of it. There was a sliver of my book that talked about these 10 or so stories that were published in Topolino. And Topolino is Italian for Mickey Mouse. And those stories about Hemingway, and they were Hemingway inspired, were never translated for an English audience. Well, I'm working with Fantagraphics, and we're going to bring that out next year. So,
what do you think, is a leap of imaginative faith, what do you think Hemingway would make of all this, Rob?
I think he would be confused by all of it, you know, because he had such a, you know, he was the author, the most photographed author of, you know, the
20th century.
And even by those standards, with that bright...
Even before Instagram.
Yeah. Even with that bright media spotlight, I think it would have been overwhelming for him. I mean, there was a reason he moved to Cuba. There was a reason he moved to Idaho. He didn't want all of that direct sunlight.
And there's also a reason he blew his brains out, too.
That's more complicated.
It's all part of it, though.
Yeah, but again, there have been so many places where I've been honored to go. One of them was I went to the last place where he lived. I was their artist in residence in Ketchum, Idaho, doing this thing for Hemingway and comics. So my love of Hemingway and comics has brought me all of this weird weird opportunity where I get to meet interesting people doing interesting things.
Well, Hidden Hemingway was born of your being in Oak Park, right?
Well, not only that, but I was the editor-in-chief of all of the Sun-Times newspapers, these 36 newspapers that were, you know, ringing the city, and now they are owned by the Tribune. But the Oak Leaves was one of my newspapers, and somebody said, oh, hey, didn't Hemingway write for the Oak Leaves? And I was like, aren't we a newspaper? Shouldn't we know that?
You're asking me?
Yeah, yeah. So what I found out was I went, because again, it's just a few blocks away from my house, I went and I discovered that he sort of wrote for the Oak Leaves. Actually, he was wounded in World War One. He was a volunteer for the American Red Cross. And so he was wounded and they published a letter home. But more importantly, he delivered the Oak Leaves. He was a paperboy for a title that I was editor-in-chief for. Yes. So that literally turned into me looking at all of these archives, because it's not just one archive in Oak Park. There are like four different places where you can look at all this Hemingway stuff. And I said, why isn't this a book? And whenever I ask that question, I spend the next 2 to 5 years of my life answering it.
See, one of the great things about you, and I always found this true at the Tribune too, with your selection of stories, is that you have that Turkle-like curiosity. You know, Studs' self-penned eulogy was "Curiosity did not kill this cat."
Yeah,
and I think it's true. I mean, that you feel that, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah. Well, and again, Studs Terkel, your friend and mine,
sure.
Studs wrote the foreword for my very first book, "Last Words of the Executed." I was always a little sad that he never got to see it. You know, he died the Halloween before it came out,
2008.
Yeah,
2008, the Halloween, did not get to vote for who he would have voted for.
Yes.
That's another fantastic book. It's the last words. Tell me about, how was that born, that book?
That was born when I was, two ways. One, I was watching Steve James's documentary, Stevie. James is actually a friend and neighbor. He lives in Oak Park. But he wasn't at the time. I didn't know him at the time. And I was watching this with my girlfriend, Kate Anthony. And we were watching this, and at the end, I'm going to give something away. Someone ends up in prison, and Kate says, I'm going to look up and see like how he's doing. And I said, really, you can do that? And she says, you'd be amazed like what prison websites are like. There's so much you can figure out, or you can see what somebody's requested last meal was. You can see their crimes. You can even see their last words. Mm. And so I lost an entire night just going through all of the websites of all of these states that had the death penalty. And again, I said, why isn't this a book?
And you said, well, I will turn it into a book.
Yeah, and it became a examination of this very American ritual. Why, if these are the most reviled people in society, why does it remain a cultural value to record what they say?
Yeah.
And so that was that examination.
Well, it shows our fascination with serial killers and our fascination with any tidbit of one of these lives. It would give us some insight into evil.
Well, and how to not be consumed by it, how to not be, I think we want to know about it so that we are not seduced by it, or we, how to identify it. I actually had this argument like with Gary Sinise of all people about about this sort of thing. And he told me, because he was very critical of mainstream media, he said, people always, the reporters always want to do a story about the house that's on fire, but they never want to do a story about that nice house that's painted well and maintained. Mm-hmm. And I said, Gary, that's not news. Like, people want to know not only what set that house on fire, but why it's on fire and how to keep their house from going, from being set on fire.
What are some of the last words of the executed that really, really have remained with you? I'm sure you could cite 50 or something from the book, but there must be a couple that haunt you to this day.
I mean, there are a couple, and they're snippets. And because I don't have the book in front of me, I can't tell you who said them, because that literally, Rick, was 16 books ago. one of them was, it's just a half of a phrase. It was like, thanks to everybody who was kind to me when I was small.
Oh,
and
wow.
That prepositional phrase, when I was small, has always just made my heart skip a beat. And then the really interesting thing about that book is you know, you would read somebody's last words and really feel for them, really have like this empathetic human reaction to them, and then read what their crime was and be disgusted and horrified.
Yeah.
And so it really is a book about dissonance and whatnot. And because, you know, it was an apolitical book, it really wanted to ask.
Right.
You know,
right,
it wasn't an anti-death penalty book. It wasn't this or that, but it just wanted to say, why is this a cultural value? Like, if these are the most evil people in society, why should we record what they say?
Why should we care?
Yeah. But I got people on both sides of the political spectrum, you know, people on the right didn't want it to exist at all. People on the left were upset that I included like a letter from Sacco and Vanzetti's lawyer that suggested maybe they were really guilty. Mm. So it was this like book that pissed off everyone and did a really, I think, because people still talk to me about it.
Sure, you know, sure.
I get calls out of the blue about it.
Well, you were listening to Rob Elder, and he's talked about his many books. I think we've given you a small sample of his oeuvre. You can go to, he's got a great website, robelder.com. I'm not going to spell it for you, you're smart people out there. Go there, buy the books, and I guarantee you will want to buy The Doomsday Clock at 75 when we resume after the news. It was set at 7 minutes to midnight when it was born in 1947, and this year it is 100 seconds to midnight. We will tell you why. Welcome back. I have neglected. We are going to move on to The Doomsday Clock at 75, co-edited by Rob Elder, my guest in studio, and J.C. Gable, who's doing something in L.A. We'll talk about J.C. He's a very interesting guy, and he's local and all that stuff. But I've forgotten to mention many of your books. Again, go to the website, robelder.com. Christmas with Elvis was a fascinating book.
Oh, it was a lot of fun, and it was a like dream come true.
How was that born?
My editor came to me. So I worked with Running Press for a lot of like really fun books. I just did some like Marvel books with them.
Yeah, right.
It was a lot of fun. But they said, and this is at a time. So, ladies and gentlemen, I started my journalism career modestly. I was a rock and roll photographer. And I had just given all of my negatives shooting shows to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I was talking to my editor about this. And she said, well, maybe you want to write about music for us. I was like, I'd be happy to. And they said, you know, a couple of months later, do you want to write a book about Elvis and Christmas? And at a certain point, I just realized, you know, there's an algorithm. Like, people love Elvis. People love Christmas. There needs to be a book. And so I realized I couldn't say no, because if I did say no, I'd have to tell my mom that I said no to doing a book about two of her favorite things, Elvis and Christmas. And it was great. I mean, they invited me to come to Graceland. It was my pandemic book. I wrote it during the pandemic.
You take your kids to Graceland?
Yeah, it was great. So they got to see that and tour the house. And it was really, really a lot of fun. And it's one of the best things about being an author and a journalist, because you get to be curious. You know, I've always said being a journalist is the best job in the world, because you're paid to be curious.
Absolutely. Let me ask you a question, because I wrote it in Sunday's paper. For those of you who still get a newspaper, I have a story in there about the movie and my brother who was on the road with Elvis and the Colonel. And he's not mystified. He's pretty good about why a guy who has been dead longer than he was alive continues to have such a grip. I went to see the movie, and I was by far, I think, the oldest person in the theater.
Yeah.
Well, what is it?
I think Bono said it best. Elvis Presley was the big bang of rock and roll. I think that's it. It's just,
boy, that's interesting.
You know, it was, you know, you had folks, and, you know, you can make a case for, you know, Rocket 88 and Little Richard and all those sort of things, but no one captured the social imagination and sort of like teen culture. Like, that was the other thing, is it stuck.
Yeah.
I would, you know, I went to Tupelo. I went to his birthplace, and Tupelo I've sort of fell in love with. I had never been there before, and it is amazing, again, because I have done, you know, pieces, I've done books about, you know, Herman Melville and Elvis Presley and Ernest Hemingway. I go to these places, and it's really interesting to see how their hometowns or the places they live remember and commemorate them.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, I just wonder, just long term, how long that will last. You know, there's a great book by Chuck Klosterman called What If We're Wrong?
Right.
It's so good. But I think about all of the other things that had museums. At, like, you know, the Liberace Museum in Las Vegas, no more.
Yeah.
There are so, you know, the Museum of Holography here in Chicago, no more.
By Warren Billings, what a place.
Yeah.
And, what a place.
But it does make me wonder, you know, what is the shelf life for some of these things? But Elvis, I think, there's an electricity and there's an undeniable voice and energy that transcends those decades.
Yeah, it's really amazing. The Doomsday Clock. Doomsday Clock at 75 is a remarkable book. Explain to me again, we touched on it, how this came to be. You were working for...
Yeah, I was the chief digital officer for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And for those of you who don't know, it was founded in 1945 by a guy named Eugene Rabinowitz. And it was these folks who had been part of the Manhattan Project.
Right,
and they,
right.
You know, they had built the atomic bomb and sort of couldn't be blind to this Pandora's box that had been opened.
Yeah.
And so it was a bunch of scientists who wanted education and transparency about this. Albert Einstein and J. Robert Oppenheimer were, you know, the first sort of, like, there were co-founders and chairs and fundraisers for them. And so, you know, they were covering all of these issues. You know, John Mecklen, who's the editor-in-chief now, just edited a book about all of the amazing people who have written for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists.
Sure.
Including, you know, Mikhail Gorbachev, Kennedy, and Nixon were in there. So it was, you know, it's a 77-year-old publication now that is a heavyweight. I mean, I remember, because I was on the digital end of things, we had a glitch at the beginning of the Biden administration, and the name of the issue was Advice to Joe Biden, or Advice to President Biden. And there was a glitch, and it didn't go to the Library of Congress. And so I had the Library of Congress say, like, hey, we didn't get sent this. So it's nice to know that, like, that, you know, it is read in the halls of power. It's this important thing, as well as a pop culture force, you know.
That it is. And so did you say to someone there, hey, it's going to be the 75th anniversary, we should do a book?
Yeah. So Rachel Bronson, who is the president and CEO, who has been a force to reckon with there, you know, she's really built that place into something truly amazing. I had been advocating for this, and at the same time, sort of unbeknownst to me, my friend and publisher of previous books of mine, J.C. Gable, had known Martiel Langsdorff, who is the female, the woman painter who designed the Doomsday Clock. He had known her, and he wanted to do something about this, and I think he has another book in the works just about her lengthy career.
He always has another book
in
the works.
Well, yeah, that's something we have in common.
Yes.
But we just talked about this because, again, it shows up all over pop culture. You know, it was a plot of Madam Secretary. There's a Doctor Who episode named after it. You know, there's, you know, Stanley Kubrick was a longtime subscriber to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and it permeates Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, Jimmy Kimmel and Stephen Colbert.
Yeah, I was actually at a Colbert taping in New York a month ago, and I kicked myself because I was three rows back in the audience, and I didn't bring a book to just hand him.
He'd like it.
No, we sent him one in the mail, but who knows? They get so much mail, you know.
The design of this thing. So JC says, you and JC are talking on the phone, you know, what do you want to do? And this thing arises from conversations between the two of you?
I think it was much more organic. I think he had been wanting to do one for a couple of years, and I think he actually pitched one, and then we sort of came at it together, and we sort of worked on it together. And thank you for the compliment about how beautiful it is. That is solely designer James Goggin. He's amazing. He's a superstar.
Well, let me ask you, there are ways to do this book where it would be a relatively plain, plain product.
Yeah, this is a beautiful four-color coffee table book. You know, it's a hardback book. It's a piece of art itself.
Oh, no question. So the designer must have gone crazy when he started to avail himself and find various images here.
I found the images mostly. JC definitely, because he has the connection with Langsdorff's family, you know, gave all of those. But mostly it came from the Bulletin's archive. So we were able to do that. I found a picture of Stephen Hawking, who had been part of the Doomsday Clock announcement, I think in 2007. And so, yeah, it was a real...
So what would this designer say when you would send him stuff? Would he go, oh, my God.
Well, and sometimes I was the same way because we would find, we would find things too late. You know, like, oh, I can't believe we missed that. Or we, the second edition of this book is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
But we kept finding, like, for example, the Justice League movie. There's a whole conversation between Ben Affleck and the Wonder Woman, or the Batman and Wonder Woman, talking about the Doomsday Clock, and there's no snooze button on the Doomsday Clock, and it's this whole thing, like, that's how you know you permeated pulp culture.
Well, one of the impressive things to me, Rob Elder, is that you have a number, if not all, the covers of the magazine through the years. I mean, these in themselves are stunning.
Yeah, yeah. And we don't have all of them. We only have the bulletin covers that have clocks on them.
Interesting.
Yeah, because it's not John Mechlin edited that book, you know. And again, that just came out as well. And that is more about the things that are in the magazine and the very important journalism and analysis that they've done. This is more about the clock, and we wanted to show how many times the clock prominently showed up on the bulletin's cover, because they're two separate things. Bulletin is the nonprofit behind the clock. It's
the
not
clock.
The clock, yeah.
And the cover is also great. We'll take one quick break and then talk to Rob Elder some more. Don't forget, the website is robelder.com. The other website is hatandbeard.com. You can get it anywhere, but go to that website to help J.C. Gable with his
dreams.
We'll be back in a couple of minutes. And Rob Elder and J.C. Gable, right again, I'll read to you. The Doomsday Clock is many things all at once. It's a metaphor, it's a logo, it's a brand, and it's one of the most recognizable symbols in the past 100 years. And if you read the book and devour the art in the Doomsday Clock at 75, it will impress you no end. It's got cartoons, if that's what you're into. Rob, you must be very proud of this book.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, I think I said it at the beginning, but
yeah,
it is the most beautiful book I've ever been part of. We have some amazing contributors. There's Maggie Taft.
Right.
Rachel Bronson, who is the president and CEO of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, writes this very sort of poetic piece about what the clock used to stand for and what it stands for now, you know, how it sort of evolved to include climate change and other man-made threats. There's some great stuff in there.
And you write in one piece, the physical Doomsday Clock, you write near the end of it, during one public tour, a junior high student asked, "Why couldn't you just move the handle further away from midnight and make the world safer?" And this guy Schwartz replied, "I wish it were that simple, but unfortunately, simply it reflects reality." Where's the clock?
It's 100 seconds to midnight.
Can you see it?
The clock itself is a symbol. It's an idea. So there is a physical clock that's in the lobby of the Harris School at the University of Chicago. So you can go see it, but the clock is a notion. You know, it's not a physical thing, really.
Yeah. Yeah. In writing this and working with this, you bring everything to it. You're now the president and CEO of the Outrider Foundation.
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah. So... it is similarly aligned. It's an ally of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And we do some native publishing and reporting about voter rights. But also we do nuclear risk as well. So, nuclear bombs, nuclear policy, nuclear history, and climate change. So, very similar things. Our founder is Frank Burgess. We have an office in Madison, but we, take writers from all over the U.S. and all over the world. In fact, your friend of mine, Kathleen Falsani, just turned in a piece about why the Russian Orthodox Church blesses nuclear weapons. It's something they physically do.
Oh, my God, is that terrifying.
So it's the same, direction my career has been going, but this is just a different part of it.
Yeah. And you've got two new Hemingway books coming out. You've got Christmas with Elvis, which is really, really a great, terrific, terrific book. Your kids think you're cool. They're teenagers.
No, by definition, they don't think I'm cool.
That's even with all the comic-related stuff?
No, if I... So I think I mentioned it, but we're going to Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con, here in a couple weeks, and I think that is the last time they will think I'm cool. Not because I was up on stage at this venerable pop culture convention, but so they can meet all of the internet cartoonists and YouTubers that they love.
Oh, that's
you know,
great.
They would think I'm cool if I interviewed, you know, like you know, Mark Rober or Hank Green, any of these YouTube celebrities that I have very little idea. You know, their idea of celebrity is totally different from mine. But I'm allowing them access to this. In fact, Eva, my daughter, said, "Oh, hey, can we go someplace so I can go have cosplay, like have a costume?" And I think my son Dylan is like, "Oh wow, I really got to bring my A game." So they're very excited for that.
When is that? When are you going out?
So I think the
doesn't have to be precise.
Yeah, the convention itself I think is the third week in July. So
yeah,
it's coming
this whole
up.
Thing that reading that you've reminded me of a story I did some years ago when I watched a old guy give a talk at the Union League Club. He was the bombardier. Mm. On the plane that dropped the bomb on Nagasaki. In Nagasaki.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he just, at the end of it, the kids didn't get it, and he was asking me, quite old, saying, did I do good? Did I do good? And I don't think he was talking about the little presentation he gave. I think he was talking about the bomb.
Yeah, and it's something that tortured a lot of those guys.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah. Think about it. He died shortly afterward. You worried about nuclear holocaust? There's a lot to worry about these days.
Yeah, I think we all should be. I mean, it's one of the reasons that the Doomsday Clock is a fascinating reminder, because you know, the executive chair for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists is Jerry Brown, former governor. Mm-hmm. Jerry Brown. Mm-hmm. And you know, he always says politicians aren't thinking about this. You know, it's something they think is an anachronism. But now, with the war in Ukraine and Putin making not only overt but like direct nuclear threats, yeah, it's the first time, I think, for this generation that nuclear annihilation is a real thing. And yeah, so, you know, I've been talking with my friend Leslie Bloom, who's also an author, about how to get, you know, in those sort of candidate questionnaires, how to get politicians to take a stand on nuclear weapons.
Well, this book will remind you. The Doomsday Clock at 75, edited by Robert Elder and J.C. Gable. Go to robelder.com. Go to hatandbeard.com. And we'll be back next hour with Jamie O'Reilly. Rob, it's great to see you. Love to the family.
Always a great to see you, Frank.